I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. It's the summer holidays and we've got you a treat. In fact, it's a very big souvenir episode. I'm Jake Cunningham, and joining me this week are Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And Caitlin Quinlan.
Hi.
That is so much pep. You know, it's like half eight. What have you been doing this morning to have that much pep?
I had a nice walk from the station, had a coffee this morning.
It's very sunny outside.
God. It's a lovely day.
Nice morning.
Yeah.
You're an inspiration to us all there.
I try.
And as well as these two, to give you even more to take home of the souvenir, we've got picture postcard guests in the film's director, Joanna Hogg, and music supervisor, Ilona Cheshire, coming up. So it is an absolute bumper episode, and we're very excited to be sharing those conversations with you. But if you've been living under a rock and you haven't heard of a film called The Souvenir, do not worry. We will give you a quick bit of revision beforehand about it, who Joanna Hogg is as well, and then we'll delve into our thoughts on this film as well. So The Souvenir is about Julie, played by Honor Swinton Byrne, if that name sounds slightly familiar. She's the daughter of Tilda Swinton, and she's playing a young film student who's struggling to find a firm direction in both life and in work. And she meets an unwavering and decisive man in the form of Tom Burke's Anthony. The two take to one another, and an intense romance blossoms. However, as the relationship develops, it becomes clear that Anthony is not being completely honest about all aspects of himself. What a naughty boy. Caitlin, can you get me and Kelly and all of our listeners up to speed on Joanna Hogg?
Indeed. So she's a British director. The Souvenir, I think, is her fourth feature film. She's someone who I think has kind of always interrogated these kind of middle class spaces, upper middle class spaces in her films. She kind of is known for very sort of static camera, observational work on kind of, you know, these intimate relationships between couples or groups of people. And I think a lot of her characters are quite insufferable in many ways. And that can be something that people find hard to engage with. But what she does, I think, is she presents a very kind of observational and self-aware kind of tableau of these people's lives. I think she's a really interesting director. She's kind of also known for not really using scripts that much. She is quite a sort of prepared improvisation, I'd say, in her films, with sort of professional and non-professional actors. There's something that can be quite loose about her films, but they're equally sort of very well researched and very prepared. And I think she sort of says for most of her films, she compiles sort of a big document that everyone refers back to, and it has everything laid out and all the kind of, you know, things that people need to know. But she's very open to improvisation and sort of, you know, script fluidity, I think. It's really interesting. The Souvenir, as I say, is her fourth feature, based on her own life story in many ways. Kind of, you know, a semi-autobiographical tale based on her own life as a young film student and a relationship that she was involved with. I think it's a really, really interesting film and an interesting look at kind of her personal, you know, memory and past.
Yeah, and weirdly, it's not weird, I suppose, but it is part one of two films, which for a pretty low budget indie film from someone like Joanna Hogg, who the name has been out there, but it's not like she's a Marvel bringing in the big bucks at the box office. It's quite exciting to see someone come out with a film immediately be so well regarded. It's a Sundance Jury Prize winner, and she was already making plans. She's been shooting the sequel already, and it's quite cool to see a film like this be having to talk about the sequel for it. I don't know why that is so exciting, but it is quite cool. And I think what's really interesting, when people might notice on the posters for this, that Martin Scorsese is down as an executive producer on it, and he's great at kind of lending his name to projects and getting involved with projects where he can boost the profile of people that are doing really interesting things. He did it earlier this year with Alice Rohrwacher and Lazzaro Felice, and I think he was like in a hotel room in London, and he didn't have anything to do, and he was staying here while shooting one of his fairly recent films, and he wanted some films to watch, and one of the films that he got sent was Joanna Hogg's work.
Really?
And he watched those and was like, who is this? This is great. And then got Martin Scorsese got put in touch with Joanna Hogg. And these are not two people that I would have thought of putting together at all, but they like really get along and really like each other's work.
That's amazing.
It's very, very cool.
It's really cool.
And so I think, thank you for that kind of truncated biography there, Caitlin. Now that we all know everything about Joanna Hogg, I think it's time to hear from her and also from some lovely roadworks as well.
Yes, apologies about that. I got to speak to Joanna Hogg for the podcast. She was really wonderful. We chatted about Souvenir, about her process in making the film, a little bit of a kind of teaser on the sequel, you know, her ideas about how she's approaching that one, just generally about how she feels about the film. So yeah, enjoy.
Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So I guess if we can start maybe just by talking about the origins of this story and the film that you have made, Souvenir, and the kind of background of it, I guess.
Well, it has a background going quite far. I think I first started thinking about this story in 1988, very soon after, only about 3 years after I was in a relationship. Mm-hmm. While I was at film, just at the beginning of film school, I got involved in a relationship that was quite challenging. I won't say too much about it, but just to say that it was the inspiration for this story. Mm-hmm. And so I, already in 1988, was making notes about it, and actually already was thinking of the story being split in two parts. Mm-hmm. That the film would be two films, not just one film, and that the first film would be about a relationship, and then the second part would be, in a sense, a response to the relationship, about a young filmmaker. So that was about as far as mm-hmm. my notes got back then. And then every now and again, I would think about this story that I wanted to make, entirely inspired by this relationship. But never, either through being involved in another project or just maybe a lack of confidence in, mm-hmm. in it, or knowledge of how to tell the story. Certainly in the late 80s, I hadn't yet started thinking about using my own life as inspiration mm-hmm. for something. So there was no evidence of being able to do that. So anyway, it took me, I think, then fast forward to 2015, and I had made Exhibition and was looking around for the next project, and that I thought, well, now is the time mm-hmm. to look back, in a way, because all my other films, the other three films, were all very much to do with the present moment. And so this was a point that I wanted to look back, and that then began a journey of rediscovering, in a sense, who I was mm-hmm. in my early 20s.
Do you think there's a kind of level of distance that you have to achieve personally before you're able to actually interrogate your own past in that way?
I definitely. I think that I needed time needed to pass before I was able to do that, and then it meant I could. I was obviously relying on my memory of mm-hmm. this time, but I started to think, well, it wasn't so much about specific memories; it was more about an impression of that time,
mm-hmm.
and also that I could tell the story more from the female point of view
yeah.
than from the sort of other half of the relationship, because I always felt, well, this was somebody I had a relationship with who I never really understood completely, and had wondered, well, how do I tell the story when I don't actually understand one of the main characters? And then I thought, well, actually, that's an interesting exploration in itself, to sort of try and discover who they were in a way, and who I was.
Mm. There seems to be a very personal angle to it, but I wonder as well, being kind of so present in your own past, did your approach as a filmmaker change, or were there elements that you kind of felt, you know, you had to step back from, or you felt you were being pulled into it too much? That you're kind of crossing that boundary between the personal and the relatable, I think, in this film. So it must be interesting as a filmmaker to live within that world again.
It was very interesting to me to revisit projects and ideas that I had in my early 20s,
mm-hmm.
and to use in a way as inspiration for this story those early creative sparks I had as a film student.
Yeah.
And that was quite satisfying in a way, because there were all these projects that never got made, that either were just remained on the page or was expressed in the Super 8 film or in still photographs. And so I was able to look at those projects again, look at those ideas and those images and sort of give them a second life in a sense.
Yeah. And with the casting process, was that more difficult because these were people that you had known in your life and you were trying to pair actors with real people, or did that not really kind of affect the process?
Well, it did inevitably.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to find someone who had some of the creative impetus that I had at the time, and the quite sort of stubborn ambition in a way of being a filmmaker, someone who could be creative and believably be that creative being, that young filmmaker in front of the camera, who isn't necessarily comfortable in front of the camera, is more, mm-hmm. more interested in recording themselves, more of an observer. So I that was a challenge, to find someone who I felt could be believably mm-hmm. be that young woman and have a connection with myself.
Yeah, and I think there's also something about the film in the way that it's scripted or not scripted, and these performances almost don't feel like performances. It feels we are observers in this life and in this story. In terms of script then and preparation, is that something that you don't kind of try and stick to in such a rigid way? You're sort of allowing the fluidity of the process a little more, perhaps, if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm writing my films, I'm writing in quite a detailed way, even though I'm not always expressing everything that everybody says mm-hmm. in them. They are actually very, very detailed manuscripts. But then what happens is it's only during the process of the shooting of the film that I let go of some of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to have this very precise map, but then it's about letting go and allowing in what's happening around me.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I find very interesting, I think you kind of mentioned it just before, about the perspective of a young woman, and watching this film as a young woman, to me there are scenes that, you know, and not to spoil anything, I suppose, but there are scenes that really I find very affecting. And I think Julie is a very apologetic character in lots of ways. And that's something that, I think as women, maybe we do too much of, and we make ourselves a bit smaller. And that, I think the film kind of really interestingly approaches that topic. I don't know if that was something you'd always felt or had in mind and wanted to portray in this film.
Well, I mean, that was definitely one aspect mm-hmm. of seeing a young woman being caught up in something that she's not able to get herself out of, maybe doesn't have the will to mm. get herself out of it. But I'm very aware now, I mean, actually I haven't watched the film part one for a while, but I'm aware that I've portrayed somebody who is very much led by the Anthony, the man she's having the relationship with, very much sort of led by him, and she does fight back sometimes, but I think I fought back possibly more than I have my character doing, and what I found is that I'm depicting her as I thought of her at that time, but now with much more, well, I've now just been shooting part two, I've had a lot more time to think about the character and wonder about the things that I omitted, that I was almost unaware of omitting, but that it's very, it's a challenge in 2 hours to completely show somebody in a 360 degree way. And I realized there's some aspects of myself that are missing, but then I sort of redress that a little bit in part two.
And I think with any kind of active memory, in a way, you're always going to have these moments where perhaps something is blurry or something is, you know, in full clarity, and it's about how you kind of navigate that, I suppose, which is really interesting for this film, how you could rewrite your own history in some ways, or, you know, introduce elements that you hadn't, you know, not necessarily lived, but yes, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. It's just, yeah, the act of memory, I think, is really interesting in this film.
Well, I allow so many new things to come into it because of the nature of the way that I work. It ends up being this patchwork of some things that are memories that I think happened, other things that are completely invented that come through my casting and a character or someone I've cast who brings something new into it of themselves, and I'm inviting those things. So it's a really sort of interesting, as I say, a sort of patchwork of sort of real and not real. And I'm a bit confused myself now about what happened and what didn't. And of course, memory it can fool you.
And I think maybe it's almost nice that you had Tilda Swinton working on this project, and I know you're good friends with her from a long time ago. There are those personal ties, I suppose, in this film to that truth of the history. But then, you know, it's almost, there's something quite satisfying about having her daughter in the film as well. And what was the process like of casting Honor and working with Tilda and that mother-daughter relationship? I think is quite fascinating for this.
Well, now it seems so obvious that it should be Honor playing Julie, but I spent many months looking elsewhere, but not finding that that person who could portray that creative inspired being, because I met actresses and I felt what their lives were about being an actor, and I wanted someone who was creating their own projects and had this ambition to be a filmmaker, and Honor in the end was perfect for that. And then there was something very natural about working with Tilda again and with her daughter, who I knew already, so it felt it felt right. And as you say, it made it feel like an extension of the past. There was something. Everything sort of connected together. But while we were working together, we didn't question it. It was something that happened. Very, very naturally. And of course, Tilda herself felt very at home in the space we created, which was based on an apartment I once lived in, which Tilda had visited many times.
It must have been something kind of eerie about that, maybe, just to have those spaces recreated.
Yes, for all of us, I think.
And you spoke about the decision to have the film in two parts. You didn't know that you were going to do that going into the first film, or that had always been the kind of the intention?
Yeah. That was always the intention. And in fact, the intention had been to shoot both films together.
Right.
To have a longer shoot and make them back to back. And I was a little bit disappointed when we weren't able to do that, and it was a financial thing because we needed to raise a lot more money to shoot both films back to back.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen. And so I thought, oh, what a shame, because there's so much of a build-up to making a film, and once you've got the momentum going, you feel, well, you could just sort of carry on.
Yeah.
It's an exhausting process. It just felt that would have been great. But now that didn't happen, and we have sort of a couple of years in between. It's I think it's a good thing, actually, because many more ideas have come about, and there's been time for the part two to develop on its own.
Mm-hmm. And you're shooting that now? That's in the process of being post-production or?
Post-production, because we finished filming a couple of weeks ago.
Amazing. And are you able to tell us anything we can expect from the film? Or you kind of touched on what the angle that you're going for, I suppose, the sort of post-relationship aftermath, maybe.
That's it. And it takes place just a couple of days after part one ended. Okay. So it's sort of pretty much part one ended, and then it goes into Julie's future and her future as a creative being.
Wonderful. Well, I will end on that note. Thank you so much for joining us. All the best for the film.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Lovely. Thank you, Joanna, and thank you, Roadworkers. That was quite the symphony. I just want to start by actually getting into Honor Swinton Burns' role in this film, because we actually spoke in our previous episode, Pain and Glory, about directors, in that case, Pedro Almodovar and Antonio Banderas and Penelope Cruz, finding trust in actors to deal with very personal work. It's very interesting that these two films are actually both out in cinemas at the moment. I would highly recommend them as a double bill. And whilst you may initially hear kind of Joanna Hogg casting Honor Swinton Byrne, her friend Tilda Swinton's daughter, as the lead in her brand new film, you might think, oh gosh, the nepotism of that, the ego and that. But thinking back to the conversation we had about Pain and Glory and this idea of directors needing to find people that they can really entrust with personal work, and it made me think that makes total sense that it would be Honor to play this role, because it's someone that she has absolutely spent enough time with and knows as a person to be able to hand over what is an incredibly personal piece of work and kind of give them license to interrogate it, interpret it, and voice it in a way that isn't entirely Joanna's. It's certainly Honor is in there as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting but I think she only cast her like 2 weeks before they started shooting. I read, I think in a Dazed article that came out on Honor, that, you know, they went through a rigorous casting process and they saw a lot of people. And then it was only like this one conversation that Joanna had. I think in the article it describes how Tilda Swinton had sort of orchestrated this chance meeting in a train station between the two of them, which is in itself a nice little story.
Yeah.
And then they had this conversation about just boys and where she was with her life, and she kind of, I think Joanna saw her in a different light, and sort of the spark was there.
Yeah. And it's an incredible innocence that comes through in the performance, which perhaps you could only get from someone who really wasn't expecting to be doing it in the first place.
Yeah, and I think this comes back as well to the idea of Joanna Hogg using non-professional actors and really kind of, yeah, not relying on people that act regularly. So, you know, this is the first thing that Honor Swinton Byrne has ever done. And obviously she's going to be in the sequel too, but acting was not necessarily one of her kind of, it wasn't in her plans. And I think that works particularly well when you're looking at a character like Julie, who is so naive in life, you know, in this moment, and doesn't know what direction she's moving in, doesn't know really how to stand up for herself in lots of ways, is very kind of unprepared for lots of things that life is throwing at her right now, regardless of how kind of, you know, wealthy and privileged she is. There's a certain sense of sort of emotional immaturity, I think. And
for me, that makes the casting very, very effective. And yeah, you know, there is the kind of the fact that this is the child of Tilda Swinton, who was the best friend of Joanna Hogg at film school. But in a way, for me, that brings the film, you know, really nicely into the present moment, because, you know, Tilda was there at the time with Joanna when this relationship was happening to her. And the fact that Tilda's daughter can now come in and sort of play the role of Joanna in this film, essentially, I think works really nicely for the kind of sentimentality and emotion of the story.
The film is certainly interrogating the class and privilege that everyone involved comes from, and actually also the feelings that Joanna Hogg as a filmmaker has. Like, Julie, her surrogate, is wanting to make a film of real people in Sunderland, and she says specifically during an interview or a funding session that she wants to escape the privilege that she, I can't remember
the bubble.
Yeah. And the film also asks us as viewers to have to do that to this film itself, I think.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, ironically, you know, it starts off with this sort of documentary-like footage of this industrial town, and that's what she's interested in. Yet the movie she's making in the film is like some weird highfalutin art.
Like a Jared Jarman type.
Yeah, kind of thing. Which is apparently what she made in film school, and her first film that she made anyway.
And Tilda Swinton was in it.
And Tilda Swinton was in it, yeah. And then, you know, Joanna Hogg is famously making films about the middle class. So she didn't quite break out of her bubble. But it's interesting to interrogate that and look at it from that lens.
Mm. Speaking of lensing, I want to talk about how she kind of transforms the way that she observes people in the film. I don't want to use the term female gaze because I don't think that is particularly well defined. It's not just the idea of a female director shooting something. But I think it is worth talking about how she photographs the film, how she photographs people. She generally keeps them at arm's length. There's not a lot of close-ups here. There's occasionally a floating camera, which will go into kind of 16mm grainy personal stuff, which I think maybe is... It's almost like this dreamlike memory of how she would have been shooting at the time. I think it's a really beautiful film to look at. Caitlin, how did you interpret how Joanna shoots the film?
I think there are some really interesting moments where she's shooting Julie and she's kind of, you know, allowing the camera to linger on her and her face and her body in certain ways. And there's one particular moment sort of as the relationship between Julie and Anthony, the old man, played by Tom Burke, is kind of developing. They're in the bedroom and she kind of walks in this lingerie set that he's bought for her in Paris, I think it is, or Venice or somewhere. And you're very aware that the camera is lingering on her, sort of, you know, stood in the doorway, but from afar, you know, you have a kind of the spread of the whole room. But there's something I think very kind of something that resonated with me, maybe as a woman, and understanding how women are often looked at in society and gazed upon, but feeling very much like you understand how Julie feels in that moment. You understand how Julie sees herself, even though we're the ones looking at her.
Yeah, it doesn't just point the camera in a mid shot to her and kind of pass up and down her body to get that kind of artificial voyeuristic feeling. Mm. It's rather that sense of being on the end of a desired look and how that can fill a room.
Yeah.
Well, I think particularly it's interesting the way that whole shot is lit. Mm. It's not...
It's lit.
It's lit.
That whole shot is lit.
No, it's not romanticized in any way. It is just like stark lighting of a room, what it would be like, you know.
Yeah, because you see the whole room and
it's bare space.
Yeah, it's bare. Mm. You see the space that she's entering into. You see the way she's kind of pressed against the door frame, and there's that vulnerability and that she's totally exposed. And I think you almost can feel how exposed she feels, which I think is there's something so interesting about that shot that really kind of hit me when I first saw it.
Yeah. And that sparse space, that's one of the many sets that was built inside this enormous airplane hangar. Mm. And so when you watch the film, you see that this is part of the set for the film that Julie is making. It's the apartment, it's the bedroom, and it's all meticulously reconstructed from Joanna's memory. Mm-hmm. But then also in a really great hybrid fashion, she asked Anna to bring bits of her childhood as well. So the bedroom is like the toys, is a mixture of Joanna's stuff and Anna's stuff. And it's all shot within this one set. And what I think is really lovely about how the film is shot and how it's edited, I suppose, as well, is that it almost comes together like a puzzle that's being built from the middle outwards. And it's like at the beginning we get these glimpses of the apartment, these glimpses of a relationship of a person and how they understand themselves and in relation to the outside world. And gradually that world and that person gets built and we see a bit more space. The apartment gets a little bigger. The camera moves a bit further back. And as Julie understands herself more, we do get this big picture. Like, it's just a really neat technique that I think comes from the fact that this film was shot in story order.
Mm-hmm.
And so Julie, or Honor, learns about the character as they make the film.
Yeah, because she wasn't given a script, was she?
Exactly. Mm. So, Caitlin, you mentioned this map.
Yeah.
That Joanna Hogg will build at the start of a project.
Yeah.
And so Tom Burke's Anthony, he had this map beforehand, months in advance. He knew this character. He knew how these events would play out.
Mm.
And Julie doesn't. And I think this relationship, which is all about, I think it's power and innocence, vulnerability, exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's really comes through from the fact that Tom Burke ultimately did wield the power of knowledge.
Mm.
He knew how everything was going to play out. He went into every scene with just that extra knowledge of how to manipulate exactly this scenario, which is so reflective of his character.
I think there's also this other really interesting layer to that, which is that, you know, Joanna Hogg doesn't sort of say that the scene where Julie discovers something about Anthony is the first time that we see, you know, on a film of shooting that scene, because it's not, because, you know, they will have done multiple takes and, you know, eventually Anna knows what's happening and maybe we've seen the third take and it's not her, you know, first initial reaction. But in a way that works so well for the character because she's willfully denying a lot of what she probably knows to be true about the man that she's in love with as well. So there's that layer to it as well, where it's like, you know, Honor gradually learns these things and is having to react the kind of surprise or the letdown or the, you know, the disappointment of this truth. But in the same, you know, way, Julie is constantly doing that. She's constantly covering up the fact that she knows more than, you know, maybe she, you know.
So that's kind of like what I was a bit annoyed about.
Yeah.
I was kind of, when I was watching the film, that kind of thing was frustrating for me to see, because I was like, how naive can you be? It's to stand up for yourself a little bit more. And I was getting frustrated that she, you know, this naivete, I was like, is it an act? Is it not? Like, you know, wake up, shake, you want to shake her out of her sort of this world that she's sort of keeping herself in. But you do kind of gradually see her breaking out against that. Cause you know, the spaces that they occupy as a couple, you know, we see a lot of privileged spaces and you get to see Julie at home, sort of in the comfort of her home and more like herself. And also you get to see her in this relationship in these very austere sort of settings. And as the film goes on, sort of as she gets to know herself a little bit more, you see her pushing back against those structures, which I think was a way of showing that she's going to break out. And I hope maybe the second film shows more of that.
I think there's something that's really interesting is that I know what you mean about like breaking out, and I think for me the film's more about breaking out of a kind of, you know, this shell that she's kind of, you know, covering herself with as a woman and as a young girl. Like, for me that's what resonates the most, whereas the kind of the element of breaking out from her privilege and, you know, her wealth in this world that she's grown up in, to me it's not so much that she's trying, or I guess she is trying to break out of that, but really the kind of the fundamental realization is that she can't and she shouldn't, because that's what privilege is about. You need to own your privilege. And I think that's what Joanna Hogg is really trying to do here. And I think that's what she does in a lot of her films. She's so incredibly self-aware, and there is no point in any of her films where you think she doesn't know that these characters are, you know, either particularly insufferable or, you know, quite hard to relate to. She's very, very conscious of that. And I think even at the start of The Souvenir, the footage that you see is actually Joanna Hogg's old film school footage. She shot that on the docks in Sunderland or wherever. She was that kind of naive young director who thought, oh, you know, a wealthy girl from from, you know, the south of England, wherever, can go and understand what it's like to live in the docks in Sunderland. And, you know, that she, I think there's something quite kind of, you know, positive in the fact that she's going back and she's saying, look, this is what I thought I could do. This is what Julie thinks she can do, but she can't. This is not her world. So for me, it's less about, it's about realizing that Julie can't and probably shouldn't try and break away from that standpoint, but she should try and understand that she can stand up for herself as a woman and as a young woman in this kind of world, dealing with a, you know, an oppressive man who she's in love with. And there's that conflict that for me resonates a lot more. I kind of get that, yeah, relating to the privileged side of it is much more difficult, but I think there's a very universal story in there when you pick out the relationship and Julie's kind of, you know, struggle through that.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we've still got a wonderful interview coming up with Ilona Cheshire, who is the music supervisor on the film. And it's a pretty eclectic soundtrack that she helped put together here. I know people may look at the poster for this film or some of the stills and think this is quite austere, upper class stuff. It's all going to be classical music. Well, think again, because this is more like, now that's what I call the 80s. There's some absolute bangers in here.
And she worked with Scorsese on vinyl.
Oh, really?
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And Hugo and Wolf of Wall Street.
Same.
Wow.
Yeah, she's a collaborator. Yeah. A great man.
Will be going into the Souvenir listening to a bit of Bronski Beat, Psychedelic Furs. It's a great soundtrack. So here is Ilona Cheshire.
Ilona Cheshire, welcome to the Curzon podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about the Souvenir and your work on the Souvenir, on which you were a music supervisor. Yep. So do you want to start by telling us a bit about what exactly a music supervisor is, what you do, and how you kind of got into this?
Well, the role can work to cover different facets, mm-hmm. really, depending on whether you're working on a feature film, a TV series, or commercials. And obviously the brief will be different, and the requirements of the either director or the narrative will dramatically differ from product to film to TV. In general, I would say that a music supervisor would start with working with the director or the producers and editor, depending on which phase of the process one came on board with. And it would be a case of looking at music ideas that may already exist, and if there were certain tracks that wanted to be used, it would be a right, we try to make that work, we try to get the rights to that track and get it signed off in as quick a turnaround as possible and for as nice a fee as possible, because budget constraints are major, especially with more independent, smaller budget filmmaking. Another aspect of it can be that one comes in with a narrative to work with, a few ideas suggested, but to mainly consult on what music may be fitting to help complement the narrative or help sell a product or just accompany and perhaps embellish a part of a story or character progression that is happening at A, B, C points. And the next stage would then be to, as I just mentioned, negotiate usage. So that's going to record labels or publishing houses to confirm who owns the rights, whether it's the publishing or mastering rights, and find out where a fee would need to be paid, who to, which representatives, depending on whether an artist is alive or dead, etc. And then negotiating, once again, the best fee that keeps all participants happy.
Sure. So can you talk about the other things you've worked on before Souvenir?
Yes, I was, in terms of budget and level of TV making, that was certainly a breakthrough for me. Prior to that, although I have a music and film background, I had been working in film in the UK for a long time, but mainly in distribution, and had smaller experiences with music supervision, whether it was short films or working for a composer for mainly commercials, who I provided a lot of research and consultancy for. It certainly was a slower process.
Sure.
Because I'm not from a record label or a sync agency, which is where nowadays most people who provide either a music supervision or sync service are, they come from. So it was after a couple of other projects, I did a lot of research on Wolf of Wall Street, and a part of that was looking at music and music that the lead character whose book the film was adapted from, music that he was suggesting, and so how it would work within the film and supporting on that. And so vinyl was my most fun breakthrough.
Okay, and then so going from that to the Souvenir then, so how did you come to be the music supervisor on the Souvenir? And then can you tell us about first meeting Johanna, first reading the script, and the kind of initial talks you had with her about the kind of what angle you wanted to go for the Souvenir?
Well, interestingly for me, the first time I crossed paths with Johanna was at a screening of All That Jazz, which was at the ICA many years ago, a Saturday afternoon, and she was doing an intro for it because she had selected it as a personal favourite. And I'd wanted to see it for years, never seen it on a big screen, so double whammy, went and saw it and was sitting pretty much right under her nose. And then it must have been a few months later, we were both at a little BAFTA reception. I didn't know anybody, and she was there with her husband, and I just thought, right, get your social hat on. And I went up and introduced myself to her, and at that time I was working at the BFI, and it turned out that she remembered me from this screening, probably because I was in her direct line of vision. And so we just got chatting, and it was shortly before I was going to New York to work on Wolf of Wall Street, and she was out there for a little while, so we caught up and we just became friends. Stayed in touch for a while, then when I came back from working on vinyl, which would have been about 3.5 years ago, she and I met up for coffee in that chit-chat. Oh, yes, I'm developing the idea for a new film. This is the outline of it. I want to use music. Oh, really? From me? That's interesting, because you've not really used music in any of your films before, perhaps apart from that one scene with the car breaks down in Unrelated. Yes. And as you can tell, I was familiar with her films. I really admire her filmmaking. And so we just started a discussion there about using my music knowledge and experience to work on a soundtrack for her. I saw the first drafts of the screenplay and started to create a list with Johanna's initial ideas in, also identifying when there may be spots in the screenplay that music wasn't allocated, but perhaps it was needed, or it would have perhaps just embellished the scene a little bit more.
So music in a period setting then, quite often in films and TV shows, when something's set in London in the 80s, you immediately start hearing London Calling or something like that. Can you talk about, so like picking music for a period setting that isn't obvious, that kind of, you know, immediately makes people think, okay, I'm in London in the 80s, but not like, oh, I'm in London in the 80s. Do you know what I mean?
No, completely. For me, because I had the opportunity to delve into my own record collection a fair bit, and although I had moved to London a decade later, I mentioned having a music background. Although I was studying film, I was working for Rough Trade, the record shops, and I was the first woman to be allowed on the Covent Garden shop floor.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And I started the jazz section there as well. So I hold on to that quite fondly.
It's an honour.
But it just meant that I, on a kind of personal excitement level, felt that it was a really interesting area to play with, because you don't want to have a really formulaic soundtrack. And also you don't want to have music that's going to be distracting.
Right.
And as I mentioned earlier, the ideal is to have music that will both complement the film, and if someone in the audience is kind of listening without getting distracted, one hopes, they will have a moment of pleasure in that, oh, I like that, or that reminds me of something. And considering the audiences that probably are already keen on Joanna's films, myself being one, it was quite easy to think, well, let's look at music that this young film student, her friends would be listening to, because they're filmmakers or aspiring artists, and they probably wouldn't just be listening to the bog standard chart-topping stuff. They probably would be thinking, that Marquis Smith, he's a funny old fella, let's get some fall on. And especially when there are a couple of party scenes.
Yes. Yeah. What are the tracks in the film that you think sort of really sum up the feel and mood of The Souvenir?
I do think that the Robert Wyatt shipbuilding, there's something very haunting about it, and it supports the visual at a nice, interesting point in the film, as Julie's already met Anthony and she is progressing with her filmmaking, and it just reinforces that message of the social study that she wanted to portray before she changes course.
And finally then, I just wanted to ask, so your work on Wolf of Wall Street and Vinyl, so working with Scorsese, who is someone who is very famous for being very specific about music in his films, and you know, he sees that something being very important in his films, compared to Joanna, who's never really used music before. What were those two kind of opposites like?
That's really interesting, because with Joanna, and the fact that this film is such a kind of personal testament to a past love and point in her life, it was a much more personal experience for her, and so I was being sensitive towards that, but also her filmmaking. Plus, I was aware that there was so much that I could bring to this film, to her creative vision. While she had her own ideas, she was very receptive to new ones. But with working with someone who obviously is a master in the truest sense. I guess because I knew him well enough by that point that he wasn't intimidating to me, and is someone that I can joke about with. It was more a case of he has particular ideas. He knows how he wants to use them. It's very much about everything being time-specific, tiny detail. There were a number of other stakeholders in the process that would have a certain expectation of a commercial level, and therefore the soundtrack that goes with it.
Okay, Alona Cheshire, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, right. So we have come to the end of our chat on The Souvenir. Any final points that you want to get off your chest? You think we've got it all out there?
Yeah, I love this film. I think it's wonderful. It reminds me a lot of Phantom Thread in many ways. It's not the kind of like dark comedy that Phantom Thread sort of has, but there's something about how precise and loose at the same time, and the aesthetics of the films I think are quite similar. There's that kind of the strange balance of a domineering relationship. There's a lot that harks back to Phantom Thread for me, which I love. So
yeah, absolutely. And once you've seen The Souvenir, there is another film out this week called Bait, which I think is definitely worth giving a mention to. We'd normally try and spend a bit more time on it, but time has run short this
week.
Yes,
it's a shame we don't have time to talk about Bait, because I think it's a really wonderful film. Definitely catch it if you can. Beautiful, solid British new film. You know, it's really, really good.
Bit of an expressionist film.
Yeah, it feels like it's from another time.
It looks like it's been pulled out of the ground.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Shot on 16.
Yeah, black and white 16. Yeah. It's great. It's really, really good.
All right. And I know we'd normally pass to our on-demand correspondent, Sam Howlett, but sadly, he has betrayed us. but I know that he would love for me to tell you all that there is a Joanna Hogg collection on Curzon Home Cinema. And that features all of her previous films. So that is Unrelated, Exhibition, Archipelago. If you're a Tom Hiddleston fan, it's a good time to be visiting home cinema. But of course, The Souvenir is on there as well as being in cinemas. So I would recommend checking out all four of those films. And if it's your first time listening to the show and you've enjoyed it, please do subscribe. You can do that on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got any thoughts on The Souvenir, we would love to hear them. We're on Twitter at Curzon Cinemas, but all of us individually, we are there as well. I'm there as at Jake H. Cunningham. Kelly?
KS_Powell.
And Caitlin?
And I am at CSA Quinlan.
And it's been a pleasure talking to both of you about this film.
Thank you very much.
Look forward to the next time. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.